From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Carl Castle. Tonight, Iowa holds its presidential caucuses. Bob Dole is expected to finish first in the field of 9 Republican candidates. Voter support appears to be shifting between several of the other candidates. From Des Moines, Iowa, NPR's Edward Lifson reports.
1/5 of Iowa's voters say they still haven't made their minds up who they'll vote for tonight. This after months of campaigning, weeks of negative advertising, and days worth of 30-minute infomercials. It all boils down to about 130,000 Iowans out of about 1.5 million registered voters in the state taking the time to assemble in meeting halls, schools, churches, even people's homes for a couple of hours tonight at more than 2,000 precinct sites around the state. They'll talk briefly among themselves about who's the best candidate and then vote in their presidential preference straw poll. The caucus, which carries importance beyond its size because it's the first major winnower of the presidential campaign, begins tonight at 7 p.m. Central Time, with final results tallied a few hours later. Good weather is predicted across the state. In Des Moines, Iowa, I'm Edward Lifson reporting.
President Clinton has been in Iowa campaigning, though he has no opponent in the Democratic caucuses tonight. In 2 days of campaigning, the president has called on Democrats to turn out in strong numbers to stand in contrast to the Republicans. Mr. Clinton drew huge crowds with numbers greater than Republican turnouts across the state. A camera crew from the Clinton-Gore campaign followed the president around Iowa, gathering material for ads from the president's meeting with farmers, students, and flood victims. Much of Oregon and Washington state are drying out from last week's floods. Attention is now focused on Idaho, where residents are preparing for the worst. The Spokane River is flooding. In Coeur d'Alene, Captain Ben Wolfinger of the County Sheriff's Department tells us that the Coeur d'Alene River is well out of its banks.
In an area where the river used to be 60 feet wide, it is now half a mile wide and runs for about 18 miles that way. Completely mountain to mountain through a valley.
Meanwhile, officials in Montana are keeping an eye on the Yellowstone River in the east-central part of the state. That's where a big ice jam is backing up water. Today's schedule started the trial of Jack Kevorkian could be delayed because of a dispute over religious issues. At issue are questions about the religious beliefs of potential jurors. Prosecutors want the Michigan Court of Appeals to overturn a trial judge's decision to submit the questions to members of the jury pool. They say questions invade jurors' privacy and could bias the selection against the prosecution. Kevorkian's defense attorney says he needs to inquire into the jurors' state of mind. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 18.51 to 5560.41. Trading is active. The NASDAQ Composite Index is up 0.23. This is NPR News. Today's Wall Street Journal is reporting that AT&T and MCI are talking about joining forces in the local telephone market. The newspaper says the talks are in the early stage, but that executives predict the two will reach an agreement to share the costs of building local phone networks. AT&T and MCI reportedly hope to share the use of facilities they already own to bypass the regional Bell companies. Telecommunications firms are looking to forge new partnerships now that President Clinton has signed into law the new telecommunications bill. It allows long-distance and local companies to compete in each other's markets. In Japan, there's been another failed attempt to rescue people trapped in a tunnel on the northern island of Hokkaido. Authorities tried again today to blast away a 10,000-ton boulder that crashed down in the tunnel on Saturday. NPR's Julie McCarthy has a report from Taipei.
For the second straight day, rescue workers detonated dynamite in a desperate last-ditch effort to reach the victims, 19 people who had been traveling in a bus and one lone motorist. A giant slab, estimated to be the size of a 20-story building, crashed onto the tunnel during a rock slide Saturday. Authorities had hoped to dig out the victims by dislodging the boulder with the blast. Hokkaido is the site this month of Japan's much-celebrated annual snow festival, where most of the victims were headed when the avalanche hit. Hokkaido is among the most seismically active areas in all of Japan. A year ago, a massive earthquake struck the island only weeks before the Kobe earthquake destroyed that port city on the main island of Honshu. This is Julie McCarthy reporting.
The Irish Times is reporting today that Friday's IRA bombing in London was a one-time attack designed to push the British government into breaking the deadlock in the Northern Ireland peace process. The bombing killed 2 people. This is National Public Radio News from Washington. Japanese financial markets are closed today for a national holiday. Meanwhile, the U.S. dollar is falling in European trading. Gold prices are mixed. Bloomberg's Jane Dwelly has more financial news from London.
German stocks rose, led by financial stocks, as bonds rebounded on speculation that German inflation will be shown to have fallen to a seven-year low last month. Stocks on the DAX index closed the session 16 points higher, or a gain of 0.6%. Bank stocks also gained as their portfolios contain bonds which are seen now rebounding. In London, stocks are mixed. Drug makers are lower after 15 major international companies agreed to pay more than $400 million to settle a class action suit in the U.S. Oil companies gained on hopes for improved earnings. Banks also fell on concern they'll report disappointing first-half earnings when the reporting season starts on Thursday. And in France, stocks are gaining this afternoon. Eurotunnel is leading stocks higher ahead of a news conference when it's expected to announce more refinancing talks. And on the currency markets, the dollar's unchanged against the mark at 1.47 marks and 0.4 of a yen lower at 106.65 yen. I'm Jane Dwelly.
The International Monetary Fund is completing work on an early warning system to help avert economic crises around the world. The system is designed to deal with one of the primary causes of the Mexican currency crisis, and that is a lack of adequate information on the true state of Mexico's financial condition before authorities devalued the peso in December of 1994. IMF officials believe that if countries publish timely, accurate reports on such things as inflation, the growth of the money supply and foreign currency reserves, investors will be able to see problems developing before they become full-blown crises. The investment firm Smith Barney has lost another high-level employee. The head of the company's Latin America investment banking division has quit. Bloomberg's Alexis Christophorus reports.
Ricardo Rodriguez left as Smith Barney begins to reorganize its 600-member investment banking group following the resignation of Chairman Robert Greenhill last month. Just last week, the firm's deputy chief of investment banking, Michael Levitt, left the company. According to a person familiar with the firm, Smith Barney will likely cut some, if not all, of its 18 Latin America bankers. The Travelers Group unit may also cut bankers on the West Coast. At a meeting of the investment banking group on Friday, Smith Barney said it would try to reduce the group's spending and increase its focus on more profitable parts of the business. The Latin America group struggled last year after the collapse of Mexico's peso. I'm Alexis Christophorus.
The Agriculture Department says Japan is the leading export market for American-produced consumer farm products. During the 10 months ending last October, the value of such exports to Japan rose 23% to a record $4.4 billion. The department says Japanese imports of U.S. fresh, frozen, and chilled red meat jumped 37%. Shipments of fresh fruit also rose. Canada is the second largest importer of U.S. farm products. I'm Carl Castle, NPR News in Washington.
This is Morning Edition. Bob Edwards is away. I'm Alex Chadwick. The winnowing out process for the Republican nominee for president begins today. Iowa will hold the first in the nation statewide caucus in which all of the candidates are participating. As voters prepare to cast their ballots tonight, many say they are still undecided about whom to choose. The decisions they make will affect the prospects for several candidates. Joining us now is NPR's Cokie Roberts. Good morning, Cokie.
Good morning, Alex.
Steve Forbes had been rising very rapidly in the polls. Now he seems to have sunk. What happened?
Well, we'll see if, in fact, he has sunk. These polls are somewhat difficult to interpret because, as you said, there are a lot of undecided voters, and caucuses don't exactly work the same way as elections, so the polling, you're not sure you're polling the right people. But assuming that it is true that he is not doing as well as he was, I guess he would say that it's because there's been a dirty campaign waged against him. He got very upset at the end of last week saying that people were making negative phone calls about him. Now the Dole campaign has said, well, yes, they did do what they call a push poll. This is the kind of polling where somebody calls up and says, well, suppose you knew that Steve Forbes was not for outlawing abortion, would that make you more favorable to him, less favorable to him, not make any difference? That kind of polling, the Dolan campaign now says it did. But I think that you saw all of the candidates coming on strong against Forbes after his very strong showing and his buying up all those ads. And I think people started paying more attention after the Louisiana caucuses last week, after Phil Graham did poorly there. And now Iowans are sort of settling down.
What do the events of the past week tell us about Iowa, just as a testing ground for the candidates?
Well, I think that's very interesting. I think if, in fact, Forbes had swept through, either coming in first or second, and if that does happen, it tells you that Iowa is no longer what it purports to be, which is a place where somebody can come from behind, doesn't have to be well known, but can get out and meet a lot of people, form an organization over a period of time and do well there. If Forbes could just run in and spend a lot of money and win, then Iowa would not be very meaningful. But if, in fact, the traditional routine works, where a candidate can come up and do well there and then move on because he's done well there, then Iowa probably is a pretty good testing ground. And the person who hopes that it will work for him that way is Lamar Alexander, who up until now has been essentially an asterisk in the polls, but seems to be coming up stronger today as an alternative to Bob Dole, but not Steve Forbes.
Cokie, a lot of people who describe themselves as religious conservatives go to these Republican caucuses in Iowa. What are they going to do?
Well, their leaders, Ralph Reed, says that they are split. He would say, have become politically mature, and some of them will go with the person they think can win, which is probably Bob Dole, and some of them will go with the person that speaks to their hearts, which is probably Pat Buchanan, who also seems to be moving up in Iowa after his Louisiana victory. I think that it is clear that although the Christian Coalition does not endorse candidates, that they have had an impact against Steve Forbes. There have been candidate profiles out in the churches over the weekend showing you where the candidates stand on a variety of issues, and from those you see that Forbes is not exactly the candidate of the Christian right. But I think that there are some interesting splits in the Christian coalition, that some are social conservatives, some are economic conservatives, but some are real economic liberals, people who care desperately about abortion or school prayer, but also have kids in college on government grants and parents on Medicaid. So one candidate doesn't necessarily speak to everyone in the group that describes itself as religious conservatives.
Are the results in Iowa tonight going to mean a lot in New Hampshire next week when they actually have the first primary?
Well, they often have. I mean, we saw with Gary Hart, for instance, coming in second with 15% in Iowa and then sweeping New Hampshire. New Hampshire likes to be ornery, so if Forbes does badly in Iowa, maybe they'll let him win in New Hampshire. We'll see. But I think that the real question is what happens after tonight for Buchanan, for Alexander, and for Forbes, and we'll see if Forbes goes on beyond New Hampshire.
Thanks very much. NPR's Cokie Roberts. U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Richard Holbrooke is back in Sarajevo this morning, where he's announced new procedures for the pursuit and detention of suspected war criminals in Bosnia. Under what Mr. Holbrooke describes as new rules of the road, the Bosnian government will submit a list of those they believe committed war crimes to the International War Crimes Tribunal for screening. Joining me now from Sarajevo is NPR's Andy Bowers. Good morning, Andy.
Good morning, Alex.
These rules of the road, how are they supposed to work?
Well, the idea, as Mr. Holbrooke just announced it, is that the Bosnian government will compile evidence that it wants to compile against people it suspects of being war criminals. And then instead of acting unilaterally, as it's done in recent weeks, which has caused a big problem, it will submit this evidence to the War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague. This is run by the United Nations. And the tribunal will decide whether there's enough evidence to detain these people. If they do decide that the government is right and there is enough evidence, then the government will be permitted to detain them if it gets the opportunity. If, say, some of these suspected war criminals happen into Bosnian government territory, as happened a couple weeks ago.
Now, the goal here, according to Mr. Holbrook, is to preserve freedom of movement and the Dayton Agreement's commitment to prosecute war crimes. Is that correct?
That's right. And these are two very basic provisions of the agreement that were coming into conflict. The first is that there is a strong commitment to prosecuting war crimes in the Dayton Accords. This is thought of as one of the most important things in the Accords because even though there is peace now in Bosnia, a lot of people are saying that without these war crimes prosecutions, there will not be justice, and people will not be able to put the bitterness of this war behind them if they don't feel like justice has been done. On the other hand, people are supposed to be able to move freely around Bosnia if they're not suspected of being war criminals. And by the Bosnian government arresting people who had not been indicted several weeks ago, that was calling the freedom of movement provision into question.
There were these arrests of senior Bosnian Serb military officers. Would this be addressed by this new arrangement that Mr. Holbrook's come up with?
Yes, it would appear that this will take care of the problems that the Bosnian Serbs had a couple weeks ago. This happened at the end of January when, among other people, a senior general and colonel in the Bosnian Serb army apparently wandered into Bosnian government-held territory and were detained. And again, they were not indicted yet by the UN War Crimes Tribunal. As far as we know, they weren't even under investigation. This was a unilateral action, and it made the Bosnian Serbs furious. They cut off communications with NATO for a while, with the implementation force here, and with the Bosnian government, and it looked like it threatened to derail the entire Dayton Peace Accord here. This does seem to have been worked out now between President Milosevic in Serbia and President Izetbegovic here in Bosnia. We hope that that means the end of this little bump in the road.
Are these Serb military officers going to be kept in custody?
Yes, it appears that they will, at least the two senior ones. After the Bosnian government arrested them, it submitted its evidence, which still hasn't been made public, by the way, to the War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague. The tribunal then decided that apparently there was enough evidence against these men, at least to carry on the investigation, and it asked the Bosnian government to keep them in custody. On the other hand, the government has agreed to release any of the people it's detained against whom there's not enough evidence, and it did that on Saturday night. It released four men against whom there wasn't enough evidence.
Thanks very much, NPR's Andy Bowers in Sarajevo. These appear to be good times for anti-abortion forces. The Justice Department has ended an 18-month investigation into an alleged conspiracy among abortion protesters without filing any charges. And those who oppose legal abortions have gained more power in state legislatures and in Congress. But then there's the trial of John Salvi, the man accused of killing two receptionists at a Boston-area abortion clinic. His trial is about to enter its second week. The murders represent a public relations problem for anti-abortion activists, and the courts remain one place where they are not having much success. NPR's Kathy Lohr reports.
It's difficult, even impossible, to get people on opposite sides of the abortion issue to agree on anything. But last month, on the 23rd anniversary of the U.S. Supreme Court decision that legalized abortion, both sides admitted that those who are fighting abortion have made great gains in the past year. Kate Michaelman is president of the National Abortion and Reproductive Rights Action League.
More states are enacting and enforcing restrictions on abortion than at any time since Roe v. Wade. Our study reveals that the freedom to choose is caught in a crossfire of attacks from the states, where 171 anti-choice laws were introduced last year, and from Congress, where 36 anti-choice measures were advanced.
On the same day, those working to end abortion touted these actions as victories. Wanda Franz is president of National Right to Life.
On the state level, we have passed 12 laws in 9 states. In Congress, we have worked to limit the funding of abortion and passed the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act in both houses of Congress.
This represents the first time Congress has voted to ban an abortion procedure and establish criminal penalties for doctors. And when Congress recently passed the massive telecommunications bill, it contained a little-known provision which could make it illegal to put information about abortion on the Internet. States have also been able to pass abortion restrictions, including waiting periods and measures to limit funding for abortion. But the apparent successes of the anti-abortion forces have been mitigated by state and federal courts, which have struck down a number of laws and levied millions of dollars in fines against groups like Operation Rescue National. Even so, Director Flip Benham cites the movement's victories.
Let's face it, abortions are at their lowest level as they have been since 1976. There are 527 fewer abortion mills than there were in 1986. There are fewer abortionists. The battle is being won in the streets. We are, however, getting clobbered in the courts, but that's just the way it is. That's our Christian heritage, and we praise God for it.
Historically, it has been the courts that have provided the important milestones in the battle over reproductive rights, not Congress or the state legislatures. Among the recent court successes for abortion rights advocates, a lower court ruling that overturned a waiting period and informed consent law in Indiana, and a state Supreme Court decision to throw out a law that would have banned late-term abortions in Ohio.
Well, we've had a number of victories in both federal and state courts, which improve women's access to reproductive health services.
Catherine Colbert is an attorney with the Center for Reproductive Law and Policy, a group based in New York that fights abortion restrictions in the courts.
For example, in a series of cases in state courts, we've been able to establish independent state constitutional rights which guarantee women the ability to choose abortion under their state Medicaid plans. Most recently, for example, we won a very significant ruling in the Minnesota Supreme Court, which restored almost 250,000 women to eligibility for abortion services.
A dozen states that cover costs associated with pregnancy and childbirth are under court order to pay for abortion services as well. There have also been some federal court victories. Back in 1993, Congress extended federal funding to cover abortion in cases of rape and incest. But a number of governors and legislators balked. They didn't want to pay for abortion at all. They were taken to court, and as a result of this legal action, 13 states have been forced to cover abortion in cases of rape and incest. During the past 4 months, there have been a series of cases in federal and state courts where judges have ruled in favor of reproductive rights. Susan Appleton is a law professor at Washington University in St. Louis. There are a number of reasons for the decisions, Appleton says, including the right to privacy and whether a law would create a so-called undue burden on women.
I think the courts are following certain important constitutional guidelines, and that's why they've reached the results that they have reached. I think courts have a certain sensitivity to particular issues that often get lost in the legislative debate, and I think that that's important.
Catherine Colbert with the Center for Reproductive Law and Policy believes there are a couple of reasons why many of the state restrictions are failing to pass muster in the courts.
Unfortunately, there's no universal answer. That is, sometimes they're poorly written because their drafters are just not very thoughtful. In other instances, they're poorly written because they want to test the limits of the law.
While abortion rights lawyers have had considerable success in the area of protecting state funding for abortion, those who oppose the procedure say the fight in the states is far from over. They point to their successes in 5 states where informed consent laws and waiting periods have made it through the courts and are now in effect. Mary Spalding Balsh is director of state legislation for National Right to Life.
What the state courts, lower courts, are doing are enjoining these laws on small technicalities that seem to ignore the real issue, and that is that the woman has a right to know certain information and that parents have a right to be involved. And I think that those cases will ultimately be overturned.
Those opposed to abortion expect every law they pass to be challenged in the courts, but Balsh says that doesn't mean they'll stop writing restrictions they feel are valid. On the other side, those fighting to protect abortion rights, like Kate Michaelman of NARAL, says another round of restrictions means more court battles ahead.
If we have to fight this out, state by state, year by year, legislature by legislature, women will not have the right to choose in many states. They simply will have a right, perhaps, of some kind in name only and not be able to exercise it.
State and federal courts will be asked to hear dozens of new cases as this battle over abortion continues. Both sides realize the composition of Congress and the courts is vital. They view the upcoming elections as a significant key to changing the balance of power on this issue. for the anti-abortion movement. The elections represent an opportunity to build on their 1994 victories, which gave abortion opponents the margins they needed in state houses all across this country. For abortion rights activists, the elections are the best hope of regaining their political clout and maintaining the right they won in the U.S. Supreme Court more than two decades ago. I'm Kathy Lohr, reporting. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Jean Cochran. Tonight's party caucuses in Iowa mark the first big event in the Republican nominating process. A large number of undecided voters has ensured some drama in a race that only weeks ago had appeared to be locked up. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold has this report from Des Moines.
State Party Chairman Brian Kennedy predicts more than 100,000 Iowa Republicans will convene tonight in churches, community halls, and living rooms in the more than 2,000 precincts. But how they'll vote is not as predictable.
When 20% of the voters in this last weekend are still saying they're going to go to the caucus, but they don't know who they're going to vote for, anything could happen.
Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole has long been considered the favorite, and anything but a decisive win here will hurt him. The block of undecideds, a divided religious right, and the late but well-financed candidacy of Steve Forbes has jostled the field and expectations. The results of tonight's caucuses will set the stage for next week's contest in New Hampshire. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Des Moines.
A deadly Irish Republican Army bombing in London last Friday will not keep Britain from going forward with elections in Northern Ireland. Prime Minister John Major told Parliament today that talks between his ministers and the IRA's political wing Sinn Féin are now unacceptable and will not take place. Major said that in light of Friday's attack, Sinn Féin's mandate is in doubt. Major said he's sticking to his proposal for electing negotiating teams in the British-ruled province. Catholic nationalists in Northern Ireland have demanded talks first before any elections in the majority Protestant region. U.S. Envoy Richard Holbrooke says he's won a promise from the Bosnian government that it will no longer arrest war crime suspects without authorization from the U.N. War Crimes Tribunal. Bosnian Serbs broke off contact with the NATO Peace Corps force and Muslim and Croat officials last week in retaliation for the arrest of two Serb military officers. In northern Italy today, a huge area of fog caused a massive car pileup. NPR's Sylvia Pajoli reports.
Police officials say about 300 vehicles were involved in the chain reaction crashes on a stretch of highway between Venice and Verona. Five cars caught fire and heavy trucks spilled their cargoes across the road. Police say a first accident occurred during the morning rush hour on the westbound lane of the highway. Then cars heading east slowed down to see what happened in the other lane. Some vehicles were crushed like accordions, others perched precariously on guardrails. Rescue teams had difficulty getting to the scene of the crash because of the traffic jams and poor visibility, which was down to 20 yards. The injured, who had to be cut loose from the mangled metal, were ferried to nearby hospitals by ambulance and helicopter. Many were in serious condition, and police say they expect the death toll to rise. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Rome.
At least 11 were killed. This is NPR. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 27 points at this hour, trading active 137 million shares. The Nasdaq Composite Index is up nearly a point. It appears that human error may be behind Friday's commuter train crash in New Jersey. One train ran a stop sign and slammed into another, killing two engineers and one passenger. Madeline Brand of member station WBGO has more.
Transit officials are focusing their investigation on the engineer of the train that ran a stop signal. John DeCurtis had been suspended four times in the 1980s for similar infractions. His record shows DeCurtis ran a red light twice, once derailed a train, and he failed to stop at a station. DeCurtis also had some difficulty distinguishing some colors, although a New Jersey Transit spokesman says DeCurtis showed no problem identifying red, green, and yellow. The New York Times reports that drug and alcohol tests on the bodies of both engineers engineers came back negative. New Jersey Transit Rail lines do not have an automatic braking system, so when an engineer fails to brake, there is no way to stop the train. For National Public Radio, this is Madeline Brand in Newark, New Jersey.
A Michigan judge has delayed Dr. Jack Kevorkian's trial on assisted suicide charges. That trial's on hold pending a state appeals court ruling about the use of religious questions in selecting jurors. Kevorkian's defense wants to know about jurors' religious views on suicide. As most rivers across the Pacific Northwest slowly recede, a flood warning remains in effect for the Yellowstone River in east-central Montana. It continues to rise. And in Idaho, the Coeur d'Alene River is also not expected to crest until tomorrow. And along with the cleanup, many areas, including Portland, Oregon, still must conserve water. This due to water supply contamination. President Clinton has declared parts of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho disaster areas, making them eligible for federal aid. I'm Jean Cochran in Washington.
This week, the governments in Britain and Ireland will try to reestablish the Northern Ireland peace process. Several years of work to solve the centuries-old conflict were undone Friday by a huge blast in central London. The bombing, the work of the Irish Republican Army, killed two people and wounded more than 100. Today, London's transport system was tangled with security alerts closing several subway stations and creating long lines at traffic checkpoints. Police broadcast warnings that the IRA could strike again anywhere at any time. This new bombing raises questions about whether talks involving the British and Irish governments and the Catholic and Protestant communities in Northern Ireland can be restarted. NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports now from London.
In the wake of the bombing, the governments were united in their condemnation of the IRA and their belief that the attack would not deter the search for peace. The difference is in how to keep the process going. The British are sticking to their call for an election in Northern Ireland in advance of all-party talks. They believe an election would give each political party a mandate to enter those talks. John Major brought this idea up last month. It was rejected then by Northern Ireland's Catholic community, which wants talks first, then an election. They were backed up yesterday by Irish Prime Minister John Bruton.
I believe the idea of having an election of the kind suggested immediately after the resumption of violence would pour petrol on the flames. I think it would be a serious mistake.
There was no public response from British Prime Minister John Major to Bruton's comment. Major is expected to make his thoughts on an election clear in a special address to Parliament later today. Although the differences between them are significant, the Prime Minister spoke on the telephone for 20 minutes last night. Both sides described the talks as constructive. However, the two are not expected to meet face-to-face until next week at the earliest. What the governments do agree on is that before public contacts can resume with Sinn Féin, the IRA needs to restate unequivocally that it will resume its ceasefire and that this time it will be permanent. But Sinn Féin leaders, such as its chairman Mitchell McLaughlin, say their organization cannot force the IRA to do this.
Sinn Féin cannot deliver an IRA ceasefire. What we can do is what we have done previously, that is begin the slow, painstaking work of building confidence in the political process and developing a proposition that we can take to the IRA leadership, and we have already begun that process.
Sinn Féin's admission that it cannot deliver the IRA's commitment to a ceasefire and its reluctance to condemn Friday's attack have led analysts to ask whether another victim of the bombing will be Sinn Féin President Gerry Adams' leadership. Analysts feel that a return to a full-scale bombing campaign will indicate that Adams no longer has credibility within his own constituency. Meanwhile, as Londoners return to work this morning amid tight security, there are conflicting reports about whether the IRA plans another attack. Scotland Yard security spokesman warned another incident could occur anytime, anywhere in Britain, but the Irish Times newspaper is reporting that the IRA has told its members that last Friday's bomb was a one-time-only incident designed to affect the political process. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
This is Morning Edition. I'm Alex Chadwick. NASA is planning to launch a Delta rocket later this week, sending a golf cart-sized spacecraft on a 3-year mission. The mission is called NEAR, for Near-Earth Asteroid Rendezvous. The NEAR spacecraft is designed to gather and transmit a bounty of data about asteroids and provide scientists with their first good look at one of Earth's closest celestial neighbors. NPR's Joe Palca reports.
NEAR is heading for the asteroid Eros, named for the Greek god of love. It's part of a group of so-called near-Earth asteroids whose orbits around the Sun take them close to Earth. Over the next 3 years, the NEAR spacecraft will creep up on Eros, arriving in February 1999, just 300 miles away from the 25-mile-long asteroid. Ultimately, NEAR will close to a mere 10 miles from Eros and may even land on the asteroid before the mission is over. On board the spacecraft, a variety of scientific instruments will determine the asteroid's chemical composition, and cameras will make a detailed map of the asteroid's surface. This isn't the first time a spacecraft has flown by an asteroid. The Galileo spacecraft snapped pictures of the asteroids Ida and Gaspara on its way to Jupiter. But mission scientist Joseph Vavirka says NEAR's pictures will eclipse Galileo's.
Our camera will have a resolution 10 times better than Galileo could achieve, basically 3 to 4 meters or 10 to 12 feet on the surface. That's good enough to see a house or even perhaps a garbage truck, to give you a scale. And it certainly is good enough to see evidence of these collisional processes that Eros has undergone. For example, if there are fractures on the surface, we'll be able to see those in great detail and infer from that when and how these things happened.
Vavirka says understanding the collisions is important because scientists aren't sure whether asteroids like Eros were once larger bodies that broke apart or whether they have always been the tiny scraps left over after the inner planets formed. Vavirka says results from NEAR will complement work being done on Earth.
For years, we have been collecting meteorites on the Earth. And we know that some of these meteorites must come from bodies like Eros. The problem so far has been that we have not been able to make the match. We cannot tell you for sure which of these rocks correspond to asteroids like Eros. Now, obviously, if we could make such a match, and the beauty of the complement of instruments on NEAR is that we can make this match, okay, then we have made a tremendous step forward, because then we can select those particular meteorites, which might be pieces of this kind of asteroid, study them in great detail in the laboratory, combine those results with what we learned from NEAR, and learn much more about this kind of asteroid.
In addition to learning what asteroids can tell them about how the solar system formed, mission chief scientist Andrew Cheng says there's a practical reason to know more about asteroids like Eros. There are a lot of them that are just a little farther out from the Sun than Earth is. Cheng says computer calculations show that in a million years or so, the gravity of the other planets in the solar system could change Eros's orbit so that it would cross Earth's.
And at that point, the possibility of a collision exists, but there's still no prediction that there would ever be a collision. However, the size of Eros is such that it's actually even bigger than the asteroid that caused the end of the Cretaceous period and the end of the dinosaurs and all that. So if there were ever a collision, it would truly be a catastrophe. But it's not predicted at this time.
Which everyone agrees is a good thing. NEAR represents a new kind of scientific mission for NASA. Under budget pressure, NASA adopted the mantra, better, faster, cheaper, creating the Discovery program of space missions costing a fraction of those in the past. For example, the Galileo mission to Jupiter cost more than $1.5 billion. Andrew Cheng says NEAR comes in at just over $200 million, including launch and 3 years of operating costs.
When we started working on the NEAR mission, we had plenty of friends telling us that it was not possible to do a full science mission for $150 million. They get it all done in 3 years. Science is too ambitious, payload's too complicated. Well, never mind all that. We did it. We're here. And the real news is that better, faster, cheaper is not just a slogan. It's reality, and NEAR proves it.
Or will prove it once there's a successful launch, once the spacecraft arrives at Eros, and once all the instruments work as they're designed to. NASA is convinced that missions like NEAR are the way to go. The next better, faster, cheaper mission will be a landing mission to Mars scheduled for launch in December. This is Joe Palca in Washington.
The investigation continues into the mysterious Caribbean crash last week of a Boeing 757 off the coast of the Dominican Republic. The chartered plane went down without warning shortly after takeoff from the North Coast resort town of Puerto Plata. 189 people were on board. They all perished. U.S. Navy sonar equipment is expected to arrive in Puerto Plata tomorrow. it's capable of picking up signals from the plane's flight data recorders, believed to be on the ocean floor some 4,000 feet below the surface. The so-called black boxes may provide important clues as to why the plane went down. Joining me now is Stuart Matthews. He's president of the Flight Safety Foundation. Good morning.
Good morning, Cedric.
What do we know about the cause of this crash so far?
Well, I think we know very little, at least the public knows very little. Obviously, the accident investigators are picking up wreckage off the sea, and they're studying whatever they can from the radar traces and things like that.
Have these things been recovered from the depth of 4,000 feet before?
There have been several accidents over past years where the flight data recorder has been at the bottom of the ocean in which they have successfully recovered it, and indeed, there was the United aircraft where the door came off, which they went looking for that, and they were able to get it out from about 8,000 feet, I believe it was.
How does the sonar equipment manage to find these things?
Well, first of all, the flight data recorder is equipped with what I might call a bleeper, which actually puts out a signal that, of course, is working on internal batteries in the actual device itself. So they'll be looking for that and homing in on that. Then they'll be doing calculations of where they think the aircraft came down and where the wreckage might have exactly sunk. And I think they have some pretty sophisticated stuff, but whether they're going to be successful or not, of course, I can't hazard a guess at the moment.
Mr. Matthews, how long will that black box continue emitting its beep, and how long will it stay waterproof at the depth where it is?
These recorders are really designed to take an incredible amount of punishment. They're designed to withstand enormous temperatures from fire and, of course, the acceleration or deceleration forces for impact and things like that. They're also waterproof, and as I said, they have the batteries and things on board which help to put out a signal in the event that they're underwater or, in fact, hidden elsewhere, depending upon the types of battery it has on board. Earlier recorders had cadmium batteries. Later ones had lithium batteries, which last longer. But I think, simple answer to your question, will be several days, typically 3 or 4 days.
It must be expensive to go looking for these things. Who pays for it?
That's an interesting question. Obviously, there are a lot of people who've got a great interest in this. The truth of the matter is, it's probable in this case that the United States has offered its services to the Dominican Republic. Obviously, a lot of U.S. equipment is being used, naval equipment and other stuff. The manufacturer's got a very great vested interest in finding out what has happened, because obviously we need to know. 757 is an aircraft that's in service, and we need to know what the problem was. Other people, too, including the insurance companies.
Isn't this the second 757 to go down in the last few months?
Well, 757's been flying for 12 or more years. It has an exemplary record, but ironically, there have now been two accidents within the space of about 1 month. There was an accident where an aircraft flew into a hillside about a month ago, just over a month ago. All the indications are that there were human factors involved in that, and it was nothing to do with the airplane.
Thank you, Mr. Matthews.
Yes, my pleasure.
Stuart Matthews is president of the Flight Safety Foundation. We don't think anything at all about these humbug man-versus-machine contests that come along all the time. But nonetheless, we were a little anxious on Saturday when Deep Blue went one up on Garry Kasparov. Mr. Kasparov is the champion of the World Chess Federation, the best player there is. Blue, Mr. Blue, I suppose, to be completely neutral about this, is an IBM computer. The two are playing a match in Philadelphia to recognize the 50th anniversary of the development of computers. We can report this morning that things are at least even again because Mr. Kasparov outfoxed Deep Blue yesterday with a wily, waited-out strategy.
It attacks, you know, it finds the shortest cut to any weakness in your position. And it doesn't hesitate, it doesn't have any doubts, it's not scared by your illusionary threat.
Right.
And that's why, you know, it was absolute worst. And, you know, it was a massacre, which was well deserved because, you know, I probably had to get better position after the opening.
The IBM team blamed defeat on what else? Operator error. Nonetheless, said programmer Murray Campbell, the human champion was very shrewd in seizing on his advantage.
He didn't let the computer play towards its strengths. He kept it more under control. Although Kasparov didn't play perfectly, he made one less mistake than the computer.
Game 3 in the 6-game match is tomorrow. The O.J. Simpson video will be in stores on Friday. It contains Mr. Simpson's first public explanation of his whereabouts the night that his ex-wife Nicole and her friend Ron Goldman were murdered. The video has been talked about a lot, but somewhat less often advertised, because media outlets, ranging from the big TV networks to the National Enquirer, have rejected the ads. NPR's Brooke Gladstone reports.
Broadcasters and publishers are squeamish. There have been calls for boycotts of the video, and they don't want guilt by association. O.J., the fallen idol, is still a big moneymaker for media, but O.J., the entrepreneur, is reckoned bad for the bottom line. The weekly magazine Inside Media quotes sources that say 60% of stations approached turned down the chance to run the ads, so Simpson has made personal raids on TV and radio shows. He appeared first in an interview on Black Entertainment Television.
When a network will do that, when a network or a local station, I saw KTLA one day had the Goldman Fund or the Brown Fund on TV so that you can send money to fight O.J. Simpson in court. Yet we try to buy time on that show so I can earn my own money to defend myself in court. They don't give me that. Now you tell me that's the American way?
The black press has been more open to ads for the Simpson video, but other news media have taken what they consider the safer road, even the supermarket tabloid The Globe. Terry Raskin is The Globe corporate vice president.
We do have standards, and I know it surprises people sometimes to find out that, oh my God, the tabloids have standards, but we really do. And I'll admit that the OJ video ad is a hot potato, and for that reason, we have decided to stay away from it. In theory, it hasn't even come to that because we have not been approached.
A curious aspect of all this is that a number of news outlets have made public their refusal of the ads even before the Simpson marketers got to them. And though the usual issues that prompt rejections do not apply in this case, obscenity, product fraud, hate speech, Raskin says it's important for the business to dissociate from the Simpson enterprise right from the start.
This has unfortunately become a dividing point for large segments of the American public, yes, whether it's along racial lines or gender lines. It was more, look at the furor over this ad. Is this something we want to even get involved with? Do we even need the money?
Most hypocritical thing I've ever seen. They're the ones that make all the money off by putting O.J. on the cover and putting him in the inside stories, and they turned us down saying it's not appropriate.
Tony Hoffman is the producer of the Simpson video, a well-known maker of infomercials, those long-form commercials for face creams, slicer dicers, and diet aids. He decries the finicky owners of major market TV stations for shunning the ads, but he is consoled by the boost in sales prompted by Simpson's forays on the airwaves, such as last Monday's surprise call to the CNN program The Burden of Proof.
I was innocent. I did not commit these crimes, and it took all of my life savings virtually to prove that, and it shouldn't be that way.
OJ, about how much did this cost you?
I'm not going to say it. Let's just put it this way. 1-800-OJ.
Tony Hoffman says sales were four times better on Monday when OJ showed up on Burden of Proof than they were on Sunday. He says he expects to more than make back his initial investment in the three-video set, but it rankles Hoffman that after the trial of the century, the media, which made so much money off the spectacle, won't let Simpson off the stand. We're all in the same business, he says.
But I found there are some people that are very, very supportive of it, saying, Tony, you're one of the best in the business, you got the tape of the decade, and good luck to you. And then I have other people that say, how could you do such a thing? And quote, use the word, make blood money. I don't look at it that way. I look at it as I'm a producer brought in to do an interview, and I did that, and it's no different than Marcia Clark making 42 years worth of salary in one fell swoop. It's no different than Darden. It's no different than NBC. It's no different than Geraldo making a living on O.J. every night. You know, there's only two people that have lost money that I know of, O.J. Simpson and the people of California who paid for the trial.
Hi, and welcome to the O.J. Simpson, the interview videotape hotline. Please listen to the options and select the proper one. To order by credit card, press 1. To order by
Though the advertising campaign is not going as well as producer Hoffman might have liked, it's still getting some play. The New York Daily News has reported that the New York Times has accepted the ad, but a Times spokesman says the newspaper never comments on ads before publication. Ads can be scandalous. When TV and magazines ran an ad for Calvin Klein jeans featuring children in sexy underwear, the media were taken aback by the public outcry. But the OJ brand comes with warnings no one can miss. The court has acquitted him, but in the marketplace, the court can be overruled by the consumer. This is Brooke Gladstone reporting.
This is NPR's Morning Edition. The editors on the National Desk are Larry Abramson, Michael Fields, Ken Barkas, Chris Joyce, Les Cook, Sora Newman, and Nancy Cohen. Bob Edwards will be back tomorrow. I'm Alex Chadwick.